This is Audible.
How to Defend the Christian Faith, Advice from an Atheist, written by John W. Loftus, with a foreword by Peter Boghossian, narrated by Matthew O'Neill, foreword narrated by Peter Boghossian.
Foreword.
Be ready always to give an answer to every man that asketh you a reason of the hope that is in you. 1 Peter 3:15. If you're a Christian and you read only one book about how to defend your faith, this is that book. It is the one book on apologetics whose guidance, advice, and recommendations will lead you to what is true. In order to discern truth from falsity, you need a resisting opponent. In the martial arts, for example, if you want to figure out which techniques work and which do not, you will need to try them on someone who does not want them to work. In other words, someone who wants to win the fight. Resisting opponents act as a corrective mechanism, that is, as a way to keep your ideas about reality in check. Getting to the truth requires checking your beliefs mercilessly against reality. How to Defend the Christian Faith is the ultimate resisting opponent for the Christian apologist. It is the title holder in the Ultimate Apologist Championship. Take it down, and you will be the new belt holder. You will know that your ideas about reality actually correspond to reality, and you will have arrived at truth. Like John Loftus, I am a professional atheist. And like many Christians, I want to know what's true. I do my best to have an open mind and sincerely consider ideas that do not comport with my understanding of reality, even entertaining those ideas that make me feel uncomfortable. If Christians have some truth I don't know, I want to know what it is so that I can know it too. Every year I speak about faith, God, and religion to thousands of people around the world. At every one of my events, Christian apologists attempt to publicly defend their Christian faith during the open question and answer sessions. After only a few minutes of back and forth questions, their arguments always unravel, yet their conviction remains. One lesson I've learned from these years of public engagement with Christian apologists is that the arguments they offer for their faith are not the reason they have faith. Arguments for God or for specific propositions within their religious tradition have nothing to do with why they believe. I know this because when I ask apologists, if you were shown, to your satisfaction, that the argument you presented was untrue, would you still believe? Virtually every apologist, when pressed, replies yes. And those who do not respond affirmatively claim it is impossible that their arguments could be untrue. For Christian defenders of the faith, I have found that convictions masquerade as reasons, arguments do not anchor beliefs, and the public defense of faith-based assertions is among the most noble of virtues. If you're a Christian reading this, you may be different in this respect. You may be willing to follow the truth, no matter where it leads, which is, as Loftus argues, the only way to defend Christianity. Thus, for the Christian apologist, reason and arguments are charades. So too are the vociferous protestations that the core propositions in their faith tradition, the virgin birth, Christ's crucifixion, the resurrection, etc., are true. Truth is a casualty of faith. Dishonesty, insincerity, and self-deception germinate the moment one becomes an apologist. When one becomes convinced they have the truth, they stop seeking the truth. As Bertrand Russell wrote, the will to find out is bartered for the wish to believe. Enter John W. Loftus's How to Defend the Christian Faith, a pointedly honest, forthright, and sincere way to approach a defense of Christianity. And Loftus, one of the world's leading atheists, is uniquely qualified for this task. He was groomed by the who's who of the top echelon of Christian apologists, William Lane Craig, James Strauss, Paul Feinberg, Stuart Hackett, Kenneth Kanzer, known as the Dean of Evangelicalism, Mark Griesbach, past president of the American Catholic Philosophical Association, and Ron Fenstra, director of doctoral studies at Calvin Theological Seminary. How to Defend the Christian Faith is a desperately needed life buoy that can prevent both would-be and seasoned apologists from drowning in a sea of dangerous nonsense. How to Defend the Christian Faith explains exactly how this can be accomplished. Such an ambitious task has never been undertaken from the perspective of someone who lacks belief. Yet it is vital because so few Christian apologists actually know how to defend their faith to the informed doubter. And because none of Christianity's claims can be rationally derived based upon the available evidence. Persuasive defenders of the faith are necessary to ensure Christianity's survival. This is because the truths of Christianity cannot be reasoned to. They cannot be derived absent messengers. Without apologists and proselytizers, Christianity would not survive a single generation. With How to Defend the Christian Faith, and because Christianity is on the decline in the West, Christians are paradoxically placed in the uncomfortable yet fortunate position of turning to an atheist to shackle them to the value of truth. Yet Loftus does not whitewash the difficulty for potential apologists. How to Defend the Christian Faith is not a feel-good, self-congratulatory book that deceives believers into thinking they can easily persuade others, or themselves, that the hope they have is aligned with reality. Rather, it's a call to honest self-reflection for lifelong seekers of truth, while providing methods and a roadmap for exactly how to proceed. In a crystal-clear, plain-spoken style, he levels with apologists. As a former apologist, he's done all the work. Loftus knows exactly what's needed to defend Christianity, and he articulates arguments apologists must answer to achieve their ultimate goal, eternal salvation through Jesus Christ. From apologetical methods to mechanisms for evaluating and adjudicating claims in the Christian faith tradition, to exploring what an unshakable commitment to truth looks like, How to Defend the Christian Faith takes readers on the ultimate journey into Christianity. Even beyond becoming knowledgeable about how to defend core tenets of the Christian faith, reading and engaging with this book offers a unique opportunity to be honest and to know exactly what it means to argue for Christianity. And much of what Loftus has to offer, especially as it relates to reason and rationality, is of value not just to Christians, but also to atheists and anyone genuinely curious about finding out what's true. How to Defend the Christian Faith is the omega of literally thousands of years of intellectual history devoted to the defense of Christianity. It is the ultimate corrective mechanism for the Christian faith, and the definitive guide to Christian apologetics and for Christian apologists. You will never have to read another book about how to defend your faith. And, after reading this book, you may never want to. Peter Boghossian, Portland, Oregon.
Introduction. In what is known as the Great Commission, Matthew 28:19-20, Jesus presumably challenged the earliest disciples to proselytize or evangelize and disciple or tutor others. They had just graduated from classes taught by the master disciple maker himself and were charged with discipling others as Jesus had discipled them. Following their example, all Christians are to be witnesses on behalf of the Christian faith, Acts 1:8. They should also always be prepared to defend their Christian faith, 1 Peter 3:15. This witnessing, proselytizing, discipling, tutoring, training, teaching, and defending are required of every single Christian to some degree. So this book is for every Christian who wants to be better at these tasks. There are, however, special classes of professional people who devote their careers to these tasks. Someone who defends the Christian faith professionally is known as an apologist. They are also variously described as evangelists, proselytizers, missionaries, ministers, preachers, disciplers, pastors, or teachers. Christians who aren't one of these professionals must financially support, encourage, and pray for these professional workers. Matthew 9:35-38. The word apologetics comes from the Greek word apologia. It referred to what defendants would do in a courtroom in response to any accusations made against them. They would try to provide a defense, an apologia, against the charges. The accused would try to literally speak away, apo, away, logia, speech, the accusations. So apologetics is the act of providing a defense of one's particular faith. The better one does this, the better of an apologist he or she is known to be. The triple aims of Christian apologetics are to 1. Provide a positive case for concluding Christianity is true above all other religious and or non-religious contenders. 2. Defend the reasonableness of Christianity against any objections brought against it. And 3. Persuade non-Christians to accept the Christian faith. The first aim is called positive apologetics. The second aim is called negative apologetics. The third aim I'll call persuasion apologetics. This book is written by an atheist, a non-believer, to Christians who feel called by their God to defend their faith from the arguments of atheists like me. As someone who had formerly been trained to defend the Christian faith by some of the best recognized apologists in our generation, and who now argues against it, what I'll say should be helpful. My goal is to show Christians how to defend their faith. That is, to do apologetics, correctly, if it can be done at all. It's also intended for atheists who want to argue Christians out of their faith, since the arguments contained within should be useful for this purpose. Given the state of apologetics, this book is sorely needed. Even Christian apologist Dr. Randall Rouser admits he has a lot of reasons to be dissatisfied with the current state of Christian apologetics. The biggest problem is the way apologetics is often taught. Rather than be trained as thinkers, many apologists seem keen to learn by rote a bunch of factoids and arguments peppered with impressive quotes from select sources. This is a desperately boring and unimaginative approach, and it suggests that the common stereotype of the apologist is merely trained to present a sales pitch is not undeserved. We need independent, creative thinkers who are equipped to think about the world in novel ways and explore the grounds for and against their beliefs from a fresh and honest perspective, free of spin and informed by their own unique experiences, interests, and contexts. There are dozens of more arguments waiting to be discovered, and innumerable creative ways one could present them, contextualized to the particular time and place in which one finds oneself. And as apologists begin exploring new ways to defend their beliefs, apologists will benefit in the long run. Reading this book will be a good thing no matter what the result. Perhaps in some cases it may help potential defenders of Christianity accomplish what Rouser wishes apologetic programs would do. Maybe some aspiring apologists will figure out how to do apologetics better from reading it, since no one has done it well so far, in my opinion. If it helps in this way, that's a good thing, right? Then would-be apologists will be better at their task by reading it. Of course, I'm writing the book because the case for Christianity is so bad I can offer honest advice for doing apologetics better, and it still won't be good enough. Perhaps in some other cases, the book might even convince potential apologists that defending Christianity is defending the indefensible. So they may be convinced to stop perusing a career in apologetics when it dawns on them the challenge is much too great. If it helps in this way, that too is a good thing, right? They might as well know this in advance of pursuing such a profession. Then they could pursue other interests and find some other productive work to do in life. Perhaps in still a few other cases, aspiring apologists might even abandon their faith from reading this book. If it helps in this way, that too is a good thing, right? I would welcome this result, of course, since I myself abandoned my faith based on conclusions I made. Truth is its own reward, since, as I'll argue later, we should be honest, lifelong seekers of the truth. Then arriving at truth is a good thing no matter what the result. The title of this book is intentionally provocative. Atheists will criticize it because there simply isn't a way to help Christians do what it proposes, defend the indefensible. Any atheist proposing to write such a book must not be a true atheist. He's either an unconvinced atheist or, worse, a secret believer. Perhaps he's motivated by money. Well, I assure my readers that if anyone is motivated by money, it isn't me, and I equally assure them I have not changed my mind. I am still an intellectually committed atheist. Sufficient evidence is lacking to accept Christianity as the truth. Trying to enter into a relationship with a supernatural being who does not exist is like trying to have a relationship with an invisible imaginary friend. Anyone who has read my other works can see why I think this way, and I stand by those words. Christians will also criticize the title of this book because I cannot be sincere in writing it. Surely I'm no more interested in helping Christians learn how to defend their faith than a vegan who writes a cookbook for meat eaters with beef, chicken, pork, and fish recipes. The truth is that I really am going to offer some sincere, honest advice to would-be Christian apologists, especially in part one. I'll also be offering a lot of snarky, tongue-in-cheek advice, especially in parts two and three. I'll offer some positive advice for what budding apologists should do, as well as negative advice, lots of it, for what they should not do. If apologists truly seek to challenge non-believers to accept Christianity, they will be helped by listening to me, an atheist who is trained by the best to be a Christian apologist. In chapter one, I challenge readers with the most important question of all when it comes to defending the Christian faith. It's the obvious elephant in the room that very few Christians even notice. Why is it necessary to defend the Christian faith at all? I mean, really, if people want to pursue a goal, they should know why they are doing so. I argue there shouldn't be any reason to defend Christianity. I challenge readers interested in pursuing that goal to ponder this question. Answers that question before proceeding any further. I argue that God, if he exists, should do all the work himself without needing any apologists, thereby attaining much better results than apologists could ever possibly get. In part one of the book, I will offer some positive advice to aspiring defenders of the faith. It is honest and helpful advice. It is also essential advice. I wish I had been given this guidance when I first sought to defend the faith that I was raised to believe. It's counsel that all apologists should take very seriously. No matter what else you like or dislike about the book, this part is worth the price of admission. In chapter 2, I want potential apologists to know precisely how challenging the task of apologetics will turn out to be. It doesn't dawn on us when we begin perusing a goal how hard it can be to achieve it, how long it might take, and whether we can achieve it at all. I remember starting out loving the game of pool, both 8-ball and 9-ball. It wasn't long before I thought I could go pro within a few years. So I practiced like no one's business, spending way too many hours in pursuit of that dream of mine, only to have it shattered years later when I realized the goal was far too elusive, especially at the age I started. I'm pretty good at these games now, yes, but there were a lot of other productive things I could have been doing that I didn't do, because I was pursuing such a will-o'-the-wisp goal. In the same way, I want potential apologists to understand how daunting the task of apologetics will be for them. I want them to know now, not later, what it takes. So I'll articulate the many of the problems they'll have to answer in the process of defending their faith. In Chapter 3, I'll argue that the would-be apologist must be resolutely committed to being an honest, lifelong seeker of truth, whether it can be found, no matter what the results. Given the vast amount of knowledge there is in the world today, no one should think he or she has landed on the truth, the whole truth, so help me Jesus. Doing so requires a lifelong diligence to courageously seek the truth, and if the evidence calls for it, changing one's mind. It requires adhering courageously, stubbornly, tenaciously, and persistently to the intellectual virtues. In Chapter 4, I'll strongly suggest that students seek to be apologists should get a good education by attending and graduating from a good university, in a good field of study for doing apologetics. Nothing less will do. In Chapter 5, I'll write about apologetical methods. Since apologetic stands or falls with the issue of method, this is a very important discussion. Which method is the one Christian defenders should use in defending their faith? There has been considerable debate among apologists themselves over method in defending the faith. My claim in this long chapter is that the only reasonable apologetical method is the evidentialist method, as it's called apologetics based on sufficient objective evidence. But as you'll see, most Christian apologists don't accept this challenge. I'll argue that aspiring apologists must accept the challenge of defending the evidentialist apologetical method, and then subsequently provide the requisite evidence for one specific branch of Christianity. I have personally studied apologetics with leading proponents of different methods, so I have a unique pedigree. I had several high-level classes with leading defenders of four different methods. At the master's level, I studied apologetics with James D. Strauss at Lincoln Christian University, who argued along the lines of presuppositionalism like Francis Schaeffer. Then I studied at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School with Stuart Hackett, the leading defender of what is called rational empiricism, Paul D. Feinberg, a leading defender of the cumulative case method, and William Lane Craig, a leading defender of natural theology or the classical method. I also took a sympathetic leaning class under Dr. Craig on the reformed epistemology of Alvin Plantinga. At the doctoral level of Marquette University, I studied with Father Donald J. Keefe, S.J., who even as a Catholic defended fideism, and Mark Griesbach, who, as a past president of the American Catholic Philosophical Association, defended natural theology or the classical method. Now I view myself as a counter-apologist, but don't let that bother you. I can teach you some tricks of the trade. In Chapter 6, if I have not yet convinced budding Christian apologists of the need to present sufficient objective evidence, then this chapter should do the trick. I'll challenge you to be sure you start off being right. You need to be sure you are correct, that you have the true particular faith, the one that can be defended from all non-believers. Don't just assume that faith you were raised to believe in is the true religious faith. You should first evaluate your faith before defending it. Maybe a different faith is the true one, or none at all. In so doing, I'll offer what I consider the only type of evidential apologetics that can actually convince reasonable, educated non-believers, something I've called the outsider test for faith. It's expressed in these words: the only way to rationally test one's culturally adopted religious faith is from the perspective of an outsider, a non-believer, with the same level of reasonable skepticism believers already use when examining the other religious faiths they reject. Consider this chapter a sort of boot camp for training soldiers for intellectual battle. As the last chapter in Part 1, this chapter puts Part 1 altogether. Consider it one of the most serious challenges to your faith, one that you should welcome if you are truly committed to seeking the truth. It should solidify the need for you to get get a good education in order to defend your faith, for you'll be required to produce the sufficient evidence needed for non-believers to accept it. In parts 2 and 3 of this book, I'm going to show how Christian apologists have so far utterly failed to convince intelligent, educated non-believers. I aim to challenge potential apologists to do better than others before them. Of course, I don't think it can be done better, but maybe an aspiring apologist somewhere can learn from me and do a better job of it. In part 2, covering 5 chapters, I'll provide many concrete examples of how recognized and important Christian apologists defend their faith. Since they are the experts, they must know how to correctly do apologetics. Using these examples, I'll show budding apologists what to avoid doing if they want to become better than any of the expert apologists I'll be writing about. I'll offer some negative advice, lots of it, for what they should not do. I'll show that these experts engage in many fallacies of reason, and as such, not much help at all in convincing reasonable non-believers. Christian apologetics so far has been, at best, nothing more than special pleading and, at worst, intellectually dishonest. If they are doing apologetics correctly, it likely cannot be done at all. Even so, this part of the book is instructive because it teaches aspiring apologists what not to do in defending the faith. When it comes to pool, I can learn how to play better by observing how others play, even first-timers. By doing so, I can learn what not to do, and that's a valuable lesson, even if I don't learn from them how the game is done right. Finally, in part 3, covering 5 additional chapters, I'll focus on just one issue, the problem of suffering for a perfectly good, all-powerful, all-knowing God. I review several Christian attempts at dealing with this problem and show how miserably these arguments fare in defending their God concept from it. Since I don't think there is a sufficient answer to this problem, I only want to show why the answers provided don't work. I challenge potential apologists to find better ways of answering it, if that is even possible. If this book helps aspiring Christian career apologists do Christian apologetics better than others have done before, then reading it will serve you tremendously. If, however, you realize you don't do it better, you should not seek to be an apologist at all. And if you realize it cannot reasonably be done at all, then as an honest seeker of truth, you should think about abandoning your faith. I want to express my thanks to Lee Pena for this copy editing help with the first part of the book, but most importantly for suggesting I write chapter 1. Final note, proof of plagiarism has destroyed the credibility of a few authors in the last few years. Keep in mind that plagiarism isn't just limited to the print media. A few video bloggers and podcasters should take note. If you get your main ideas from any authors or use their exact words, then you should give them due credit. We'd appreciate this. It's considered to be common decency. You may be sorry if you don't. Chapter 1. The Most Important Question of All. In this chapter, I'm going to address the most important question of all for would-be Christian apologists. It's the obvious elephant in the room, not seen by apologists because they don't have the eyes for it. My argument is that God, if he exists, failed to effectively communicate his will. He failed to provide the sufficient evidence we need to believe. Since he failed us, apologists have been given a tremendous workload, bigger than any one of them can bear up under. But if God had done a better job, there would be little, if anything, for apologists to do. In fact, God didn't even need to hire apologists at all for this most important job. He could have done all the work himself. Thus, the most important question of all, why is it necessary to defend the Christian faith at all? I'm going to do a job performance review of the Almighty. I used to believe in God. I used to defend his ways. Now I'm an atheist. I don't believe in him because his job performance rating is so poor he probably doesn't exist at all. He could have done better, much better, if the goal was to save souls from the pits of hell. First, I'll share why and then offer 4 other ways God could have done a much better job. If God supposedly gave up Jesus to die on the cross for our sins, which is the greater deed by far? Then why has he failed and continues to fail to do enough to reach non-believers, which represents the lesser deeds? I mean, really, if God did the greater deed, then why doesn't he also commit himself to doing the lesser deeds? Isn't that backwards for an intelligent being? It would be like preparing an extravagant, delicious banquet with enough food to feed all the starving people in a refugee camp, but not caring enough to send out workers to tell them about it, or hiring incompetent workers he knows won't do it. If you think God is doing the lesser deed, then read onward, Christian soldiers. Why has God given the most important task of them all to Christians, according to their own theology? They are still sinners on this side of heaven, lacking complete sanctification and consequently lazy, self-absorbed, greedy, lying, lustful, fallible, ignorant, finite human beings. Most Christians who attend church services are much more interested in networking with others, finding a mate, being entertained, or learning lessons from pop psychology on how to be a good person, because for some reason they need reminding weekly than in reaching out to people who, according to their own theology, are headed straight for an eternal conscious torturing hell. Compared with an all-knowing God, even the best Christian defenders are bumbling idiots and incompetent fools. Compared with an all-loving God, even the best Christian defenders are utterly self-centered and completely unconcerned that people are going to hell. Compared with an all-powerful God, even the best Christian defenders are totally lacking any energy to help people believe. Surely it stands to reason that many people have not accepted Jesus as their Savior because Christian defenders lack the motivation, the energy, and the necessary smarts to do so. Christians who lack the smarts haven't even known where to look for the needed evidence to believe, much less found it. This doesn't make any sense at all, especially if there is a flaming hell to pay for those who are not convinced to believe and be saved. Surely a God like the one Christians believe in could have been more concerned for the lost than hiring the church to do this important job, surely. If Christians have been incompetent with this task, then God was incompetent in hiring them to do it. God should have cared for the lost more than that. As the CEO of his corporation, his hiring practices are a failure. God should fire them and do the work himself. The problem of divine miscommunication. Not only are God's hiring practices poor, so also are his communication skills. If there is any miscommunication in the company, the kind that can bring a company to a halt, the kind that can lead people to do different things by pulling in different directions, the kind that can cause a lack of overall purpose, then the buck clearly stops with the CEO. God is the ultimate CEO, so he is to blame for his company, the church, at least partially if they cannot adequately defend the nature and purpose of the company. I consider this problem, which I call the problem of divine miscommunication, to be a most serious one for a God worthy of the attributes ascribed to him, a God who is also believed to have revealed himself in the Bible. Christian apologists worthy of the name must deal with this most serious problem by defending God's lack of clear divine guidance. A God worthy of the attributes ascribed to him should have prohibited certain kinds of barbaric behaviors and abuses in any given society. Here are five commandments God should have spoken, but for some failure of reason or malfunction of foreknowledge failed to do so. You should not torture or kill anyone for being a witch or anyone with a different faith or anyone with no faith at all. You should not prohibit the free expression of ideas, the free exercise of one's conscience, or the free assembly of peacefully organized people. You should never enslave or beat into submission anyone anywhere, anytime, under any circumstances for the express purpose of servitude, nor treat any person as less than a human being ever. You should not treat women as inferior to men, but rather with equal respect and dignity as equally valued members of society. You should not abuse animals, trap them, raise them in factory farms, hunt them for furs, or needlessly experiment on them. This is just a very short list. The needless suffering that these five commandments alone could have stopped over the centuries is incalculable. A God worthy of the attributes ascribed to him should have communicated better, so there would not have been as many doctrinal disputes as there were a matter of life and death to Christian believers down through the centuries. Just the most basic knowledge of the human propensity for selfishness, greed, and lust should have been enough for God to foresee the need for a better revelation. The Church, for instance, fought several wars in her history that were intended to be genocidal in nature against others who claimed to be Christians. This took place in the centuries after Emperor Constantine adopted Christianity as the state religion. It also took place just after the Protestant Reformation, when 8 million Christians slaughtered each other because God did not communicate the correct doctrine clearly to them. A God worthy of the attributes ascribed to him should have known about vaccines and revealed that knowledge to us. That knowledge would have been very helpful during the most devastating outbreak of the Black Death Plague, which killed a third of the population of Europe in the 14th century. This knowledge would have been very helpful during the near worldwide pandemic of Spanish influenza from 1918 to 1920, where between 50 and 100 million people died. Such a God would have known enough to reveal how to discover penicillin, anesthesia, and antibiotics. He should have warned us about the dangers of bloodletting, the failures to boil polluted water before drinking it, and lead poisoning. According to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, washing our hands saves lives. It is one of the most important steps we can take to avoid getting sick and spreading germs to others. But Jesus denied the need to do so in order to win a debate with the Pharisees in Mark 7, 1-23. God didn't even warn us about eating poisonous plants or the various poisonous species out there, whose bites or stink could kill us. A God worthy of the attributes ascribed to him should have warned us about building cities on or near the fault lines of the earth. These fault lines attract us like honey does to bees. From them we get our water and minerals as the earth opens up and grants us access to them. If he had warned us about the dangers, many millions of lives would have been saved from earthquakes, landslides, floods, tsunamis, and volcanic eruptions. Because such a God did not tell us these things, billions of people have died, sometimes torturous deaths. God's defense lawyers in retreat. If you believe God inspired the canonized Bible, ask yourself if God could have foreseen the problems that would surface in our modern era that have triply discredited the Bible as barbaric to democratic-minded people, superstitious to scientific-minded people, and unhistorical to historians and to an ever-growing number of biblical scholars. The probability of the claim that the Bible is God's word is inversely proportional to the amount of work it takes Christian apologists to defend it from objections to the contrary. That is, the more work its defense requires, the less likely the Bible is God's word, and it requires way too much work to suppose that it is. Consider the sheer number of books that have been published by the following Christian apologists or scholars: C.S. Lewis, Norman Geisler, William Lane Craig, Richard Swinburne, Paul Copan, Alvin Plantinga, N.T. Wright, Chad Meister, J.P. Moreland, Gregory Boyd, Gary Habermas, Stephen Cohen, Douglas Gruthius, Peter Van Ingwen, Randall Rouser, Michael Murray, William Dembski, Richard J. Bachman, Michael Brown, D.A. Carson, Dan Wallace, G.K. Beale, Craig Blomberg, Craig Evans, Stephen Davis, Donald Guthrie, Ralph Martin, Richard Hess, Dinesh D'Souza, and Timothy Keller, to name some of the more noteworthy ones. While some of these authors deal with the same issues, most of their material is unique to them. If we add in their magazine and journal articles, we already have a small library of works. If we were to get and read the references they quote from, we have a whole library of works in defense of the Christian faith, for a comprehensive case. That's what a comprehensive apologetic requires. The important question left unaddressed by them, as always, is why a defense requires so many books. Why does Christianity need such a defense at all? The fact that it takes so much work to defend Christianity is a strong indicator all by itself that the Christian God either does not exist or doesn't care if we believe. If God had done a better job of revealing his will, there wouldn't be much of anything for Christian defenders or apologists to do but share the gospel message like evangelists do. But since the God of the Bible didn't do his best, Christian apologists are forced to defend their faith against the multitude of objections raised against it. It's as if God gave Christian defenders permanent job security, forgetting that there are eternal destinies at stake, people who, on some accounts, will suffer conscious torment forever because of it. When dealing with the problem of divine miscommunication, Christian defense lawyers seek only to get their divine client acquitted, no matter what the intellectual or moral cost. Rather than face this evidence that shows their God to be nothing more than the product of ancient people who didn't have a clue about civilized matters, these apologists use convoluted legalese to obfuscate and confuse the jury. Typically, they'll say we couldn't possibly know what an omniscient God is thinking, so we have no right to judge him and his ways. However, even if this is the case, it changes nothing. Millions of people died because God didn't correctly reveal the truth. Christians will further object by saying we just don't know if God did anything to help these people who died, to which the obvious answer is that this is my point. If God did something to help these people, then there is no evidence that he did. Think about it. There isn't any. This objection is based on faith, not evidence, the very thing reasonable people should reject if they want to honestly know the truth. And if God really wants us to believe in him and believe that he loves us, this is a strange way of going about things. For an omniscient God would have known that later generations of intelligent people would find to be guilty of not doing what decent people would do if they could, and as a result, disbelieve in him and his love. The best Christian defense lawyers are liberals who admit that their texts in the Bible that, to a great degree, are reflective of an ancient outlook rather than the rigid literalism of conservative believers. In their view, God's revelation is progressive, becoming better as humans grow up to understand the divine. In other words, theology evolves. Liberals didn't come by this conclusion easily, though. Down through the centuries, they came to it as the realities of life, as the result of science forced them to accept it. Yet this view is exactly what we would expect to find if there is no truth to their theology. It's what we would expect if there is no divine mind behind the Bible or the Church. If there is a God, then his so-called progressive revelation is indistinguishable from him, not revealing anything at all. And as such, progressive revelation should be rejected as an unnecessary theological hypothesis unworthy of thinking people. Furthermore, such a view actually undermines their theology, for it leads to theological relativism, since there was no point in the history of the Church when any theologian could say that a final, unchanging theology had been attained. So the theology of yesterday was true for Christians of the past, as the present-day theology is true for others, as the theology of tomorrow will be true for still others. So don't talk to me about an unchanging theological truth. Don't talk to me about an absolute standard for theological truth either. It doesn't exist. never has, never will. Liberals, therefore, cannot say any theological truth that is true for all time. As far as they can know, the end result of revelation could be the death of God, or the conclusion that we don't need God, which would make him effectively dead. As far as liberals can know, atheism may be the future of their theology. The only reason they won't accept the relativism of their theology is that they perceive a need to believe. They are playing a pretend game, much like people in M. Night Shyamalan's movie, The Village. In my opinion, liberals should just stop pretending. The bottom line is that the whole notion of progressive revelation is a heads-I-win, tails-you-lose strategy. If their God had revealed the truth from the beginning, then these Christians could use that as evidence that he exists. Because he didn't, they have introduced the concept of progressive revelation, which betrays their desire to believe no matter what the intellectual cost. What they're doing is justifying their God after the facts rather than asking before the facts what they would expect of their God if he lovingly communicated to human beings. Did God do his best in providing sufficient reasons to believe? Apart from God's lack of communicative skills, in addition, he did not provide good enough reasons for reasonable people to accept Christianity. If everything about Christianity makes rational sense, then God could have created human beings with more intelligence so that Christianity's intellectual problem would be solved. He would have merely created us with a greater amount of intelligence. Or he could have written the mother of all philosophical papers by answering such problems as why there is something rather than nothing at all, or why there is so much suffering. He could have provided reasonable answers to questions about the atonement, the Trinity, divine simplicity, the incarnation, the relationship of free will and foreknowledge, and how it's possible for a spiritual being to interact with a material world. Christians born into their faith within an already Christian-dominated culture may claim God has already explained the necessary things, but for most people in the world, he didn't explain enough. And because he has not done enough to help us understand these things, he is at least partially to blame for those who do not believe, especially if he knows in advance that people will refrain from believing if not provided with sufficient evidence to do so. Short of helping us to understand these mysteries, God needed to provide us with sufficient evidence to believe and less evidence to disbelieve. God could reveal himself to us in every generation in a myriad of ways. What better way to show us that he exists than what the book of Acts says he did for Saul of Tarsus on the road to Damascus? If God could convert Saul without abrogating his free will, he could convert anyone without abrogating their free will. He could also incarnate in every generation and do miracles for all to see. He could spontaneously appear and heal people, or end a famine, or stop a war, or settle an important question like slavery. He could raise John F. Kennedy from the dead for all to see. He could restore an amputated limb in full sight of a crowd of people at the touch of a Christian faith healer. He could do any and all of the miracles he did in the Bible from time to time, including miraculously feeding 5,000 families. The list of things God could do in each generation is endless. God could also have made this universe and the creatures on earth absolutely inexplicable to science, especially since science is the major obstacle to faith. He could have created us in a universe that couldn't even remotely be figured out by science. That is to say, there would be no evidence leading scientists to accept a Big Bang, nor would there be any evidence for the way galaxies, solar systems, or planets form. If God is truly omnipotent, he could have created the universe instantaneously by fiat and placed planets haphazardly around the sun, some revolving counterclockwise and in random orbits. God could have even created the Earth as a flat disk, allowing for no plausible natural explanations at all. Then, when it comes to creatures on Earth, God could have created us without any connection whatsoever to each other. Each species would be so distinct from every other species that no scientist would ever conclude natural selection was the process by which they arose. There would be no hierarchy of species in gradual increments. God could have created fish and mammals, but no reptiles nor amphibians. Then evolutionary theory could have never gotten off the ground. There would be no deposits of fossils that show this evolutionary process because evolution wouldn't exist in the first place. Human beings would be seen as absolutely special and distinct from the rest of the creatures on Earth, such that no scientist would ever conclude they revolved around the lower primates. There would be no evidence of the unintelligent design. The existence of this kind of universe and the creatures in it would be inexplicable to science, such that the existence of God would be the only viable explanation. As far as the historical evidence goes, the all-powerful Christian God could have made it much more persuasive. Someone could have made a monument to Abraham that still exists and could be scientifically dated to his supposed time period. There could be overwhelming evidence for a universal flood that covered all the Earth's mountains. Noah's Ark could have been deposited exactly where the Bible says it landed and would be exactly described in the Bible. Lot's wife, who supposedly turned into a pillar of salt, would still be preserved and known by scientific testing to have traces of human female DNA in it. There would be non-controversial evidence that the Israelites lived as slaves in Egypt for 400 years, conclusive evidence that they wandered in the wilderness for 40 years, and convincing evidence that they conquered the land of Canaan exactly as the Bible depicts. But there is none. Furthermore, God could answer the prayers of Christians in such distinctive ways that even those who don't believe would seek out Christians to pray for them. Scientific studies done on the prayers of Christians would meet with overwhelming confirmation. Had God created such a world, he wouldn't see the religious diversity that has divided the people of the world into distinct geographically located faiths. If God has foreknowledge, he could have predicted certain events in history like the rise of the internet, or the exact time of the 2004 Indonesian tsunami. He could have foretold the day that TV was invented, or the atomic bomb using unambiguous language that would enable all to see these events as prophetic fulfillment. God could have predicted several things that would take place in each generation in each region of the earth, so that each generation in each region of the earth would have confirmation through prophecy that he exists. There could have been clear and specific prophecies about the virgin birth, life, nature, mission, death, resurrection, ascension, and return of Jesus in the Old Testament that could not be denied by even the most hardened skeptic. The gospel accounts of the resurrection could have all been the same, showing no evidence of having been written incrementally over the years by superstitious people. The gospels could have been written about the same time, months after Jesus rose from the dead, and these stories could have been free of implausibilities. Evidence like a Turin shroud could have been preserved and scientifically shown to be from Jerusalem and dated to the time of the crucifixion. The shroud could contain an image that could be explained in no other way than that a crucified man had come back to life. Christians will claim God has given us enough evidence to believe, but the existence of billions of sincere non-believers is strong evidence that God has not provided the evidence needed for all, or even most of us, to believe. The bottom line so far, if God had much better communication skills and if he had provided good reasons to believe, then there shouldn't be anything for Christian apologists to defend about their faith except to share it. Or, more precisely, to the degree that it takes to defend the Christian faith, then to that same degree the Christian faith is unlikely, and it takes way too much to defend the Christian faith to think it has any likelihood to it at all. What if Christians went on strike? Christians should force God's hand to see what he would do if they stopped defending and sharing their Christian faith. They should all go on strike. If they stopped all apologetical and evangelistic work, would their God step in and do something to save people from hell? Or would their God let the masses go to eternal damnation if his followers went on strike? If Christians stopped doing all the work, we would learn whether God loves sinners more than his defenders do. Workers go on strike when they are overworked and underpaid. So what would happen if Christians from around the world went on strike? This strike would be against having to do all the evangelistic and apologetic work themselves. What if they stopped praying for others to be saved? What if they stopped telling others about Jesus? What if Christians stopped evangelizing and arguing on behalf of Christianity? What if all evangelists, missionaries, and apologists went on strike and instead let the Holy Spirit do the work? I'm serious. What would happen? I know Christians believe they should do the work all by themselves, so this will never happen. Consider it a thought experiment instead, intended to force Christians to think about what God is doing now. Can God do this work himself? If he can, then why does he need Christians to do this work at all? If he cares, really cares for people, then he should do something himself. Would God step in and show he cares if they were to go on strike? Would he do what is right because it is the right thing to do regardless of whether Christians helped him? Would Christianity survive and even thrive into the future because God would be forced to get involved? Or would Christianity die out as God lets the world and its people go to hell? If Christians were to go on strike, there would be no cause for concern. If God is really inside the Christian faith, then it cannot fail. The theme of the book of Revelation is God's victory in the end, so the faith response is to relax, since God's victory is assured. My prediction if Christians all went on strike is that Christianity would soon afterward go out of existence. That's my prediction. This, of course, would be because God doesn't exist, just like all the other gods and goddesses that don't exist. The Christian faith needs people of faith who proselytize and defend it. This is true of every religion, so Christianity is no exception. You would expect it to be the exception, though, if it were true. Without people of faith, any given religion would die out because there is no deity behind any of them. That's what Christians think of other faiths. They should think of their own faith in the same way. For those Christians who believe, the Christian faith would not die out if they went on strike. They need to provide some objective evidence that God is doing something now that would help convert people even if they stopped defending and sharing the gospel. God could have done all the work himself. For Christians, you must argue for the status quo, that given our present world, this must be the best way for God to have run his company. I intend to show differently. I'll show how God could have done the work all by himself and done it much better, guaranteed. I'll offer four different plans of salvation in what follows. If an all-knowing God had thought of them, then a perfectly loving God would have implemented them. The fact that he didn't do differently, when he could have done so with much better results, presents a good case for such a God does not exist. With God, we're often told all things are possible. Christians believe this until an alternative divine plan is suggested that appears to be better than what God is believed to have done. Whenever someone suggests a better divine plan of action, then without even pausing to think about it, Christians argue God could not have done differently for a variety of reasons. So God can apparently do anything up until someone suggests he does something different. In other words, true Christian believers have no imagination at all. They unnecessarily limit their God by their utter lack of imagination. Divine Plan 1. If God exists, he could have eliminated the middleman, so to speak, the prophets, apostles, and inspired authors who got God's supposed revelation wrong. He could have depended almost exclusively on revealing himself in the natural world alone. There would be no need for a book supposedly produced by inspiration or prophecy. I don't even need to offer any suggestions as to how the Christian God could have done this, because I have ideas based only on what is conceptually possible for an all-knowing, all-powerful, and all-loving God. An all-knowing God would know how to do this. An all-powerful God would have the power to do this. After all, he supposedly created the world from nothing, and an all-loving God would be motivated to do this. However, I can indeed imagine how the Christian God could have done this if he exists. Let's use just one example, that of George Washington, the first president of the United States. No serious person who is concerned with the truth doubts that George Washington was the first president of the United States. We would seriously question any person's integrity or question whether one's cognitive faculties were functioning properly if, after looking at the evidence, he or she still refused to accept this fact. We don't need any special revelation from God to know this fact. The objective evidence shows us this, such that I don't even need to rehearse the evidence here. If it's the case that God wanted us to accept as true every event we read about in the canonical Bible, then those biblical events should have the same historical evidence for them as we have for George Washington being our first president. Or to say this more precisely, the more important it is for God that people accept the historicity of certain biblical events, then the more important that evidence should exist leading reasonable people to accept the historicity of those biblical events, without the need for biblical revelation at all. So I see no reason at all why God, if he exists and wants us to believe, needed human beings to write down any special revelations or scripture at all. Everything written down would just be representative of the facts. That is what allows reasonable people to think George Washington was the first president of the United States. How would this apply to the stories of Moses and Jesus, two of the key figures in the two testaments of the canonical Bible? In the case of Moses, the events we read about in the book of Exodus through Joshua, including the 10 plagues, the wilderness wanderings, and the conquest of Canaan, would have been consistently reported in the ancient world by several different Mesopotamian cultures. Furthermore, with incontrovertible textual and archaeological evidence that these events occurred, just as we find for George Washington's presidency, people would reasonably come to the conclusion that there is a God who loves the people of Israel, and that the Israelites are a special people among others. From these events alone, reasonable Israelites would have concluded that since they are God's special people, he will send a redeemer when they are suffering prolonged hardship as a nation. God could also teach them about right and wrong through pain and pleasure, but mainly by pleasure. He could make sure they understood everything essential by what they experienced anyway. And guess what? That is exactly how we're told they learn truths from their God. So nothing else changes. God could teach them by experience, not by words, if he wanted to do so. There are lots of unnecessary lessons that can be eliminated here, given the existence of the hard evidence I just suggested, like predictive prophecy and the whole animal and child sacrificial system. And given what I'm about to say about the life of Jesus, we wouldn't need any evidence from prophecy anyway. With regard to animal sacrifices, they were unnecessary and done away with in the New Testament, along with the need for circumcision. Anyone who thinks otherwise lacks an imagination. The same standards of evidence would go for Jesus in the four canonical Gospels. Everything in them would have overwhelming substantiation, from his sermons and teachings to his healings, and especially his death and resurrection. Jesus would write down his own story in his own handwriting. His disciples would take copious notes of his sermons, and they would all agree with what Jesus wrote down and with what the other disciples wrote down as well, with no discrepancies. Other key rabbis and Roman guards would do the same. They would be reliable trial manuscripts handed down to us in writing by eyewitnesses in Herod's and Pilate's courts. These texts would all be available as eyewitness accounts immediately after those events occurred, rather than as second, third, or fourth-hand accounts. The manuscripts they wrote would be preserved intact with the direct handwriting of the authors themselves, instead of as copies of fourth-hand accounts that were then copied and recopied until the first manuscripts we possess are from the 4th century CE. There would be archaeological records of earthquakes at the death of Jesus, astronomical sightings from as far away as Rome, Egypt, and China verifying the sun turned to darkness, and records from King Herod and Pilate and many others that the saints of the Old Testament arose from the grave when Jesus did on the first Sunday. There would be other evidence, too, like a real Shroud of Turin that could be verified to have originated in Jerusalem at the time of a man described to be Jesus who came to life from the grave. None of this would be considered special revelation. It would just be the verification of the events God would want us to all to accept. Once we accepted this solid evidence, we would be Christians. Upon accepting this evidence, we would be saved from our sins. We would subsequently want to live in gratefulness for what Jesus did for us on the cross, and hope to be with him in heavens when we die. We would want others to know of this evidence, so we would share it with others. The essentials of Christian theology would be adequately deduced from the evidence to believe. Ethics could be taught by the trial and error experiences of life that could be built into the laws of nature themselves for rewarding good behavior and punishing bad behavior. Divine Plan 2. If God exists and he could just speak to everyone directly, he could be a voice in everyone's head. Why not? Why should God just speak to the prophets, apostles, or inspired authors? What makes them so special, the only ones to communicate God's voice to us? There would be no miscommunication about what to think or what to accept or what to do when it comes to essential truths of Christianity. It would include any and all historical facts that support Christianity, like the death and resurrection of Jesus. There would be no need for a Bible, no need for natural revelation either, or evidence. Just grant everyone direct access to God in those essential areas, and those areas alone. Any sincere person who really wants to know what to think about God or what to believe or do would know. God would not force himself on anyone, though, so he would never tell anyone who is not interested in his advice what to think or do, since any advice or counsel God offers could always be rejected. This would be similar to what Christians already believe took place in the past anyway, except that in the Bible God spoke only to a limited number of prophets, apostles, and inspired authors. If he spoke to them, why can't he speak to us all? If so, what's so problematic with people hearing actual voices in their heads, coming from God, voices that are communicating with everyone who wants to hear the truth? This would be a sure way to communicate to people. Only the true disobedient would reject these voices. We might even call these disobedient people the insane ones, for in this different world, the people who listen to the voices in their heads are the sane ones. Divine Plan 3. If anyone thinks having direct audible access to God is somehow bad, counterintuitive, or just plain crazy, then consider a somewhat different way. Let's say God wrote the truth about everything he thinks is essential to salvation on every person's mind from birth, to be understood better and better as we age throughout our lives. It would contain the knowledge of historical events that are essential to our salvation too, like the death and resurrection of Jesus in the 1st century CE, along with theological and ethical truths based on the Pauline, Petrine, and Johannine epistles in the New Testament. We would truly have a full sensus divinitatis, or sense of divinity, along with all the essential theological truths irrespective of their rational merit, and irrespective of the evidence for or against them. It would be there. We would know it tacitly, subliminally, intuitively. We wouldn't need any Bible to have this knowledge. All we would need is to cultivate it by meditating on it, praying based on it, and acting on it. The sensus divinitatis, as I just described, would not be written in big, bold, permanent ink, so to speak. We could deny it if we wanted to do so, just by not thinking about it, ignoring it, not having it reinforced with like-minded people, not caring to accept it, or not acting on it for any number of reasons at all. Here, then, would be a propositional revelation without human prophets, apostles, inspired writers, preachers, or Sunday school teachers involved, and it would be accurate and convincing to anyone who has any propensity at all to accept that revelation inside their heads. Christians already believe the truth is written on everyone's hearts, and only by a willful rejection of that truth can anyone refuse to believe, so there should be no problem with this alternative divine plan either. Divine Plan 4. If the evangelical God exists, then Theodore Drange argues as follows. 1. God wants all humans to believe in him before they die. 2. God can bring it about that all or almost all humans believe before they die. 3. God always acts in accordance with what he most wants. 4. If God exists, all or almost all humans would believe before they die. 5. But not all humans believe before they die. 6. Therefore, God does not exist. If we assume God exists and stop Drange's argument at the first conclusion, sentence 4, his argument entails that all or almost all humans will believe and be saved before they die. Drange argues that if a person wants to know the truth, then for God to directly implant true beliefs into his or her mind would not interfere with, but would rather comply with, this person's free will. Then whatever God did to help people believe would not interfere with their free will. So God could perform private miracles for honest truth seekers. He could even take away the critical thinking faculties of honest truth seekers, making them believe despite any problems with the unreasonableness of faith and despite any lack of sufficient evidence to believe. If it complies with a person's desires, there is nothing wrong with God doing so. It would be a much better plan to reach the world with the message of the cross. Drange further argues that people really want to know the truth. They want to be shown how the world is really set up. Now, it's really hard for me to envision that there are people who don't consciously want to know the truth, so his argument seems quite sound to me. God could do all the apologetical and evangelic work himself. Even if there are people who don't want to know the truth like that, God's involvement in this world would make the rejection of Christianity a very rare thing in the world. Conclusion. I have presented 4 alternative divine plans of salvation, where there would be no need for Christians to defend their faith or evangelize, all of which are better plans than the one God supposedly instituted. I guarantee you, if God had revealed himself in any of these 4 alternative ways, no one living under one of these alternative divine plans would ever suggest that the present world we live in is preferable, in which God gave Christians the task of defending the faith that was communicated poorly and failed to provide good, solid reasons to believe in him. No one. It's only under our supposed divine plan of salvation in this present world that these alternatives seem strange, odd, weird, or impossible. If someone were to try to object that these alternative plans don't allow for free choice in matters of religion, Christians living under those alternative divine plans would respond by rhetorically asking how anyone can know what's best when compared to God. God is all-knowing, so he knows how much truth to give people, and no more, they'd respond. Who are we to judge God and his ways, they would scold. If any of these 4 plans were what God had done rather than what Christians believe he did, there would be nothing for apologists to defend. There would be nothing much for Christian defenders to do at all. Nothing. God would do all the work himself and do it much, much better. God's present job performance rating is poor, really extremely poor. He's lazy. He should not have chosen incompetent Christians to do work that he should have done. He's ignorant. He failed to communicate the knowledge that would have been communicated to us. He's incompetent. He failed in providing good, solid reasons to believe. Even Donald Trump would have said to this God just the very first episode of Celebrity Apprentice, "You're fired." Chapter 2. Realize in Advance the Monumental Challenges. I think it's fair to inform students what they're getting into when they choose a discipline of study leading to a particular career, don't you? Some students are not cut out for some careers. Some people should not be brain surgeons or rocket scientists because they lack the smarts. Others shouldn't be police officers or pastors because of ego problems. Somewhere along the line, preferably early on, responsible people, people who know, should try to steer some students away from particular careers for various reasons. But if we let some students go into some fields without advising them differently, we're likely setting them up into some fields without advising them differently. We're likely setting them up to fail. Someone should tell these students what they're going to face in a given career before they pursue it, if possible. They might not listen to us, but we should tell them anyway. No one told me how tough it would be to defend the Christian faith, so I'm going to do these students a favor here. Who knows where I would be if I had read a chapter like this one before pursuing apologetics? It's hard to tell. I still think my effort to lay out the monumental challenges will be worth it, so here goes. Hold on to your seat. I should say from the start, no one can have a scholarly grasp of all the apologetical issues I'm about to summarize, certainly not me. Scholars specialize sometimes on real, minute issues, so the would-be apologist student can relax. You won't be called upon to defend your faith against all of the following arguments. You should still be aware of them. You should still think through them. I consider them to be important faith-destroying arguments you'll have to face. These are some of the issues you can see mentioned or argued for in greater depth in my other books. To get a full feel of the challenges you will face as a defender of the faith, get and read my other books. So let's begin. Arguments to God's existence. There are 2 areas that are not up for debate as far as I'm concerned. The first area concerns philosophical arguments that purport to show God exists. They are all such a failure that even discussing them is boring to me. That's right. They're boring because they've been reformulated and then defeated so many times by smarter people than I am that they're no longer worth bothering anymore. I know my readers may still disagree, but I cannot take them seriously anymore. The interesting debate to me is with the coherence of God, concepts or lack thereof. In 2010, atheist philosopher Dr. Keith Parsons announced he was done teaching philosophy of religion classes. According to him, several atheists have produced works of enormous sophistication that devastate the theistic arguments in their classical and most recent formulations, and as such, have presented powerful and, in his view, unanswerable atheological arguments in his words. I think a number of philosophers have made the case for atheism and naturalism about as well as it can be made. I now regard the case for theism as a fraud, and I can no longer take